Employee revenge, they say, is best served cold. And no one has more time to plot their revenge than a fired employee. While some people are able to receive constructive criticism and move on, others can obsess on what they see as failure. And when they blame their boss, their coworkers, or even just the person that does the firing, watch out. Today's case is about revenge. This is the story of how a scary situation became deadly and how tax work pressures are just not worth it. Join us as we discuss how, in one firm, tax work led to murder. Welcome back, everyone, to Tax Crime Junkies. I'm your host, Dominique. I'm a CPA, certified tax strategist. I have an interest in true crimes. I have a degree in law and lead the American Institute of Certified Tax Planners. And with me today is my oh-so-lovable co-host, Tom Gorzinski.
Hey, Dom. I'm Tom Gorzinski. I'm an enrolled agent. I'm admitted to practice before the United States Tax Court. I'm a tax instructor, and like you, I have a real interest in true crime. So we decided to create a true crime podcast to combine our love of mysteries, whodunits, and tax. We are the Tax Crime Junkies.
So Tom, I'm not sure if you realize this, or maybe you have. According to a survey by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants, or what's known as AICPA, more people are leaving the tax accounting field, and the least number of new grads are entering the tax accounting field than ever before. Have you noticed this?
Oh, I have. And many people in the profession are talking about it, about staffing issues and how to solve that problem. Just go on social media sites, go on tax Twitter. It's the big topic. And the job can be stressful, particularly during the busy tax season, where the norm is a high volume of work and really tight deadlines. Employees also bear the responsibility of ensuring accuracy in their work, given the really large financial and legal implications of the tax filing process.
That's right. And often these conditions do not end after busy season is over. You know, they always say, oh, it's only till April. But burnout is the number one reason that accountants quit their jobs.
Yeah.
So it's things like those long hours, the high stress levels, the heavy workloads. It's all that that actually leads to the burnout. And of course, that creates physical and mental exhaustion. And then you add in the low pay relative to the bad working conditions, and new workers just aren't willing to do it. They're not going for it.
Oh, absolutely. And I wouldn't blame them. And as you said, Dominique, this is not a tax season problem alone. For sure. And as you said, Dominique, this just isn't a tax season problem. We tend to staff up in preparation for tax season. We bring in temporary staff. We bring in part-timers. We bring in remote workers. We even outsource to overseas to try and solve this staffing problem. Because when a firm is short-staffed, it puts pressure on everybody, but especially the partners and owners of the business who are ultimately responsible not only for workplace conditions, stress levels, but the quality of the work output. What do you do to prepare for tax season, Dom?
Well, I have a relatively small practice, Tom, by comparison. So I'm pretty adequately staffed year-round, and I've evened out the workflow, so we really don't have that heavy concentration during tax season. But I definitely know the pattern of hiring and training and preparing the winter before the big storm comes in February. And I think most practices expect to work 70 to 80 hours per week during the season. And that's just to be able to meet the demand and deadlines.
Yeah, and that's just not healthy. And I agree with you. I have a very small practice as well. And so I really try to keep a very strong balance between how many clients I can service and the time I have to spend, because I don't want to do 70 or 80 hours a week.
Right.
What about working conditions, Dom? I mean, I can share the craziest stories I've experienced early in my career when we did go through that stress level when people are exhausted, irritable, depleted, and stressed. You may not know this, but I actually got my start in tax at H&R Block.
Why?
Yeah, and I worked there part-time for two seasons before I kind of went tax full-time and went a different path. But I can just tell you that working in that office in Center City, Philadelphia, in the last week of April was a nightmare. And if the staff was overwhelmed, the patrons of the store were anxious, they were upset, it was just a mix of a really not great situation.
I bet. Man, you should have just called in sick for that whole last week.
I wanted to, trust me.
That's the benefit of not being the boss, Tom.
Sometimes you can call out sick.
Wow. Well, you got to get your start somewhere, but H&R Block, that's pretty bad. You know, I'll never forget my first tax season. I was working for a large firm, and I had just made the change from audit to tax. And so my desk was moved upstairs to the dark side, as the audit department called it. And as I came down the hall looking for my cube, I heard this loud commotion. I couldn't tell what was being said, but it was yelling. And just as I was about to cross a doorway of one of the managers, a file came flying into the hall.
What?
You know those emojis with the wide eyes? Yeah, that was my face in that moment. And I'm not sure what emoji face I had when I found out that that was my new manager.
And I thought I had a bad in H&R Block. Wow. Did the file thrower ever do that to you?
Of course not. I always need her happy. Insert angel.
But sometimes when the bulk of a firm's work occurs during a very small sliver of time, that busiest season, there are layoffs or even planned sabbaticals afterward.
Yeah, but usually the employees are aware that they're being brought in on a temporary basis. But I suppose it could also be a method of pruning your team. You know, you keep the good ones and you terminate the bad.
Right. And this could be the way to make sure your team continues to get better and better. But it's very rare, at least in my experience, that a termination happens during the middle of tax season, right?
Yeah. I mean, it happens, but usually it's people quitting.
Yeah.
People generally can just suck up their annoyance with the bad ones at least till April 15th, because nobody wants to pick up the slack. And that's what today's episode is all about, right, Tom?
That's right. This episode is about to be a mind-blowing ride that is sure to make you think twice before the next time you have to fire someone. Get ready to buckle up, because we're about to dive headfirst into the gripping tale of Anthony LaCalamita, a guy who got laid off and decided to seek revenge. Hold on tight, because this story will have you on the edge of your seat from start to finish.
When you say laid off, is that just another way of saying fired?
It's a kind way of saying fired. I would agree.
Well, let's go ahead and get started by peeling back the layers of intrigue and suspense. And we're going to start by uncovering the shocking truth behind the fired accountant named Anthony LaCalamita, but also his crime. And so brace yourselves, as Tom said, because this tale is going to keep you glued to your seats.
Our story starts with a horrifying incident that shook the tax industry just days before the tax deadline. Okay, imagine this. Regular, plain old accounting firm, suburbs of Detroit called Gordon Advisors. The workplace is humming with activity. Keyboards are click, clack, click, clack, click, clack. Printing is printing, printing, printing. Phones are going off all the time. right? That's the normal tax business in April. But it's not so ordinary after all. On April 9th, 2007, chaos erupted in the seemingly normal workplace.
I couldn't believe this story when I first heard it, Tom, and you won't believe what happened next. You know, we work hard, right?
Yeah.
And you can imagine that when people get ready to retire, they worked hard all their lives. You've supported many professionals at a tax firm and finally reached retirement. And just picture yourself, you've gotten to that retirement, you're enjoying your time off, but you still have this fondness for your work family. And when they call, you willingly commit to come back and help during tax season. You're probably counting down the days when you can return to your puzzles, your naps, your long walks, and watching Jeopardy every evening. You've got just 4 days to go before the deadline. And you don't think much of a recently fired Anthony LaCalamita entering the building and walking past your receptionist desk in the front. And you probably also don't notice the 12-gauge shotgun that Anthony's got gripped at his side, pointing down his left leg.
So, Dom, this is back in 2007, and we did have mass shootings back then. We had them before, but it seems like we didn't have as many as we do today.
No, I definitely. And so maybe people weren't so vigilant about that. Right. And also just consider how busy and focused we get during that time of year. I mean, sometimes I don't even notice somebody standing right next to me in the office if I'm really engrossed in something. And so I certainly would not be looking for workplace violence at all.
No, and it gets even more intense than that, Dom. The one responsible for this violent act was tax accountant Anthony LaCalamita, a recently fired employee, and he had a bone to pick. Armed with a shotgun, he stormed into the office, fueled by a desire for revenge against those who he believed wronged him. Now, LaCalamita had a target in mind as he made his way to the second floor, seeking out the people he blamed for his dismissal. But here's where things take a chilling turn. He asked for all the partners to meet him in the conference room.
Oof, you really got my heart pounding. Thinking of those workers who didn't notice the problem employee coming up the stairs. Can you imagine being summoned to your death? The chaos did not stop there, though. Alan Steinberg, who was the managing partner, and Paul Riva, who was also a partner at Gordon Advisors, they found themselves caught up in the crossfire of LaCalamita's rage, all while they were just having a simple meeting about a client. So LaCalamita's coming down the hallway, making his way down. He's headed for the meeting in Steinberg's office. And the unsuspecting victims are distracted with work papers and dockets. And as he pointed the rifle at one of his former managers, Alan Steinberg, LaCalamita just asks one simple question, and he says, "Do you want to get shot?"
And as soon as he asked the question, Alan got up to move the shotgun away with his arm. LaCalamita asked him to sit down. Alan approached him and told him he could not have a gun at the office and reached again as LaCalamita asked the same question again. "Do you want to get shot?" Pulling the trigger, hitting Alan in the thigh, and Alan dropped to the floor.
Oof, that's just chilling. So they actually knew this guy, right, Tom? Like, how long did he work there?
Well, he had been fired just 4 days prior to this incident. But he had been employed for at least longer than a year, and while as a staff accountant, they described him as friendly and conscientious.
So he wasn't just satisfied with shooting Alan alone. He had actually come with someone else in his sights, someone who luckily wasn't present in the office at that time. And the workers were horrified. People were cowering under their desks as LaCalamita stormed from that bloody office. He's running down a long hallway. He passed, people in their offices and cubicles. and no one had a concealed weapon or anything, so nobody could help there. The reports and the accounts from the people inside the office talked about the murderer making eye contact. And, you know, these are all coworkers, so it's someone you know. And so you're trying to get away from this guy, and then he's making eye contact with you. And within a few seconds, it didn't take him long, and he reached his ultimate destination, which was Paul Riva's office. And by then, Madeline Cafori, this is the receptionist that I talked about in the beginning of our story. This is the one who had retired. He had passed her in the front of the office, remember, and she didn't really notice him so much. And by then, she was standing in Riva's doorway, and she was asking for that requested meeting in the conference room at his request. And this person, she's a mother of four, she's a grandmother of five, met him there. And La Calamita shot Cafori in the abdomen. He blasted buckshot throughout her body and, you know, it shredded her vital organs, basically, and she died right away. And then he turned to an unarmed Paul Riva and just said, "Goodbye, Paul," and shot Riva in the chest.
That's really chilling. You know, while Calamita seemed to be well-liked at the firm, he had taken a several-week medical leave in 2006, and by February 2007, he started missing work for suspicious last-minute appointments. In late October 2006, a man and woman understood to be a pimp and a prostitute came to Gordon Advisors complaining about a $200 debt that La Calamita had paid for with counterfeit money. Steinberg met the man at a Home Depot the next day and actually paid the pimp slash prostitute the money as a favor to La Calamita.
Wait a minute. Steinberg, the one that he shot? The one that he was like, "Do you want to get shot?" Oof. And for that, he's helping the guy out and then he gets shot.
You would think that would win him favor. But it turns out to be more than just seeking revenge here. La Calamita was also hospitalized for depression in the last 5 years, according to his estranged wife.
Right. The wife actually was helpful in understanding what was going on with this guy, who really seemed to be struggling a lot with mental illness before this happened. And according to his wife, Michelle, Anthony La Calamita had been diagnosed and treated for depression and other mental disorders for several years, but he had never exhibited any violent behavior. And I think that's what makes this tough. You know, how can you warn anybody off if the person is not showing signs of violence?
Right. People get depressed all the time.
Right. And they had been married for a long time, since 1998. But she had recently moved out a few weeks before this happened. And after their marriage, he started having even more mental problems. Apparently, he attempted suicide by taking an overdose of pills, and he had to have his stomach pumped. And he realized that he had a problem that needed treatment, and he agreed to a hospitalization about 2 years later. And in 2002, he attempted suicide a second time.
Yeah, it seems like the firm maybe understood, and they actually took a caring and understanding role with him. After deciding to terminate La Calamita, the partners at Gordon Advisors actually made sure that his wife, Michelle, was back from an out-of-town trip before they fired him on the 5th, so he would have a support system at home. I mean, even though they had not lived together for 3 weeks. A partner at the firm, Kevin Klein, shared that piece of information.
Now, Klein was the partner who actually saw La Calamita from a balcony in the atrium, right?
Yeah, he's the one. He had a look on his face that was, quote unquote, menacing with a purpose, as Klein testified to in court.
That's really scary. it's tough being the partner of a business. You have your staff cowering under the desks. They're barricading themselves in offices, hoping the shooter doesn't come their way, and just being completely helpless. I mean, people, of course, were calling 911 by then, but many times I think our teams don't realize the responsibility that we assume as owners of the business, not only for the clients and for the work, but for our employees' safety and for their livelihoods. And so it seems La Calamita was frustrated at his failed marriage, his finances, and ultimately losing his job. How was he stopped? How did they stop him eventually?
Well, the authorities certainly wasted no time in responding to this incident. They arrived quickly at the scene, they secured the area, and they made sure the rest of the employees were safe. Unfortunately, La Calamita actually escaped before they could apprehend him.
So that's when the high-speed chase began, and it was like something that you see on TV. Anthony La Calamita fled the scene. He was sparking a heart-pounding high-speed pursuit that gripped the entire area, and the police were determined to bring him to justice.
Law enforcement officers, including sheriff's deputies and state police, chased him for about 30 miles. At one point, they were up to 120 miles per hour, even daring to pass through a construction zone on the notorious Interstate 75. And it was just a crazy race against time.
Yeah, for both of them, I imagine. But La Calamita's trying to get out of there and the police are trying to get him. And so after about 15 minutes of that, La Calamita finally decided to just pull over. Probably it's that he realized the consequences right. of not doing so, or maybe he was just thinking, how does this end? The undersheriff named James Gage mentioned that fear may have played a role in his decision to stop. And it was a moment of relief for the pursuing officers.
Oh, absolutely. But they got their man. So during the arrest, La Calamita remained silent, subdued by the overwhelming circumstances. The officers discovered a 12-gauge pump-action shotgun and live shells in his vehicle. Witnesses on the scene had already reported that he had used either a shotgun or rifle in the office.
So that's just further convincing him that he's the guy. Unfortunately for the victims, Madeline Cafori, Paul Riva, and Alan Steinberg, they were caught up in the middle of the shooting. Madeline tragically lost her life, as I mentioned, and Paul and Alan were rushed to the hospital with serious injuries. Alan was able to be released right away, but Paul's injuries were much more serious, though he did survive.
It's heartbreaking, though. During the court arraignment, Madeline Cafori's daughter, Charlene, she couldn't contain her grief. She sobbed uncontrollably, clutching a picture of her beloved mother. She firmly believed her mother was innocent and had no role in his dismissal from the firm.
Yeah, absolutely. And just the circumstances are so heartbreaking because she was out. She was retired. She did her time. And she came back. I imagine some of the people who invited her back probably have survivor's guilt. It's just tragic all around. Nobody deserves to be caught up in something like this. So he was facing La Calamita. He was facing some serious charges for his actions. He was charged with first-degree murder for Madeline Cafori's death, and he also was facing charges of attempted murder for the shootings of Paul Riva and Alan Steinberg. And on top of that, he was charged with possessing a firearm during the commission of a felony, and for fleeing and eluding the police. You know, I can't even imagine why anyone would sell him a weapon if he had been suicidal. It seems like he had been suicidal pretty close to this incident.
Well, he bought the weapon apparently a week before the shooting, but that actually wasn't his first attempt to own a firearm.
That must have been right after the firing then, if it was right before the shooting.
Yeah, it looks like La Calamita had actually been turned down for a handgun purchase permit in March, though the police won't say why.
Well, perhaps that was why. Although when they searched his apartment, They found paperwork for the purchase of his pump-action shotgun, and sure enough, the day after the firing is when he purchased that gun at Target Sports. I guess there's no statutory waiting period for purchase, for a purchase of that nature and at that type of location.
During his arraignment, a not guilty plea was entered on behalf of L'Calameda. The judge made sure he understood the charges against him and the potential consequences. The seriousness of the situation was emphasized, as a conviction for first-degree murder could mean a life sentence without parole. As a result, L'Calameda was ordered to be held without bail.
Well, I would hope so. And the poor people from that firm, they must have been terrified to go back to work. Yet. But it was April 9th, and you've got the deadline. It's not like the IRS just grants extraordinary extensions for one single murder. And it sounds callous when I say it that way, but to them, you know, the IRS, it wasn't like a national emergency or something.
Right. And the law wouldn't allow them to even do that. But this is where the tax and accounting community really pulled together to help the firm. And if it's one thing I've ever learned about tragedies, they tend to bring out the good in people.
That's right. And accounting associations did just that. They really were quick to act. They offered aid to Gordon Advisors and its employees and clients that were really, you know, reeling from the shootings. I wouldn't want to go back in that office. And so employees of the firm, of course, were dealing with their grief, their trauma. Accounting industry leaders pitched in to make sure that no one at Gordon had to worry about the deadline so that they could file those federal tax forms at midnight just a few days later. Leslie Murphy, who is a past chair of the AICPA, helped initiate discussions with the IRS officials in Washington to allow Gordon to delay filings beyond the deadline. That's a pretty big feat to accomplish.
It is.
And they notified the AICPA that it would waive the penalties and allow a reasonable delay for current clients of Gordon.
Wow, and that's really unusual, but I really give the IRS credit for that. Numerous firms also contacted, offering assistance and resources to help Gordon Advisors through this difficult tragedy. The IRS actually released a statement saying, quote, "The department is sensitive to the tragedy that occurred there, and we are working with them."
So during the trial, L'Calameda's defense argued that he was insane at the time of the shootings. And I mean, we could see this case going that way, right? The defense of not guilty by reason of insanity. But the assistant Oakland County prosecutor, Rob Novi, successfully argued that L'Calameda was of sound mind. So Novi's case, he's emphasizing that the actions were deliberate, they were planned, they showed signs of anger, and they definitely showed that L'Calameda had an understanding of the difference between right and wrong. And that's really the test that you have to prove.
I mean, it looked that way, right? He purchased the gun. He seemed to conceal it as he entered the office. He took off on a high-speed chase to avoid arrest. Assistant Prosecutor Robert Novi highlighted the purposeful nature of L'Calameda's actions, suggesting that his bipolar disorder should not be used as a defense. Novi stated that the shootings appeared to be premeditated and that the mental illness cannot excuse his criminal behavior.
Well, they proceeded to use the insanity defense anyway. I mean, I don't know what other defense they really had. But in the closing arguments, the defense attorney for L'Calameda, his name's Jerome Fenton, and he claimed that L'Calameda couldn't have faked 7 years of seeking treatment for bipolar and depressive disorders. And so over that period of time, he's getting help from mental health professionals. And the argument is, he couldn't have faked that, but...
But there's a twist. The jury didn't find the argument convincing. They rejected the alternative verdicts of not guilty by reason of insanity and guilty but mentally ill. Additionally, L'Calameda was convicted of assault, with the intent to murder and several other gun charges.
I think it's important to remember and say here, too, that there's lots of people that live with bipolar disorder and they do not ever resort to violence or something of this nature.
Absolutely. The trial took place with Circuit Judge Rudy J. Nichols presiding. The sentence was announced on May 23, 2008. The trial actually included compelling testimonies from the victims and the witnesses of this terrifying office shooting. It also delved into discussions about a possible sexual addiction, conversations like Calamita had with his family after his arrest, and the details of his arrest following the high-speed police chase on Interstate 75, where, of course, he was apprehended with the loaded gun.
Now, he goes off to prison, and at first it seems as if Anthony LaCalamita, despite his circumstances, really was starting to turn things around and have this incredible story of redemption.
Yeah, while he was serving a life sentence without parole, LaCalamita found solace and purpose within the Confraternity of Penitence, which is a Catholic ministry with statutes prescribing various penitential works. He dedicated 4 years to intensive training and finally made his pledge. But that's not where the story ends.
Now, for a while there, he was also channeling his energy into making a positive impact. He became deeply involved in what they call the PAWS program, P-A-W-S, training service dogs. They have them at various prisons around the country. And it actually is pretty remarkable that out of the 30 dogs that LaCalamita worked with, 23 went on to become service dogs or advanced training.
Wow.
And I would love to wrap this story up with a story about redemption, but I'm afraid we cannot end it here.
No, we cannot. After several appeals were denied, something came over LaCalamita and his darker instincts came out again. On February 16th, 2008, he set his sights again on murder.
He did, unfortunately, and while we don't know the reasons why, he lured a corrections officer to his cell so that he could kill the corrections officer.
That's right. Though the corrections officer says he didn't know LaCalamita, he approached his cell door, which was open. As he approached cell number 16 to close the door, the officer could see LaCalamita's eyes glaring at him from the crack in the doorway.
Creepy. That sounds like that scary look he had while he was searching through the office.
Yeah, and as the officer approached, LaCalamita jumped him and began stabbing him in the neck with a shank he carved out of a toothbrush.
The officer didn't even realize he was being stabbed at first, did he?
No, it wasn't until after he was put in handcuffs that the officer realized he was bleeding extremely close to his carotid artery. So LaCalamita had another trial and was found guilty of assault with an intent to murder, and was sentenced to an additional 10 to 25 years in prison on top of his life sentence without parole for the previous crimes.
Well, maybe it's not surprising at this point. He'd appealed the first sentence, got denied. He appealed this sentence as well, and he cited mental illness and insanity for this issue and was saying he didn't get adequate defense counsel because they didn't plead, you know, not guilty by reason of insanity. And that's always a tough thing for me to understand, Tom, because you'd really have to be insane, cruel, heartless to do these types of things.
It really is confusing, but the test is, did he know what he was doing was wrong? And in this case, the court found he could have used that defense, but chose not to the first time around. And he demonstrated he knew how to use the defense based on his first trial for murder at the tax firm where he raised it.
So I guess that's not hearsay, right? If it happened, you can't argue there. Can't argue with that decision. So this story really serves as a chilling reminder of the devastating consequences that can arise from unchecked workplace violence.
The incident has garnered attention from HR and workplace violence experts, and it really highlights the importance of training, counseling services, and respectful termination policies, all of which can minimize the risks of workplace violence. They suggest considering a progressive discipline process as an alternative to just a sudden termination.
Yeah, it's just really hard. This is a tough situation, and it's hard to look backwards and see what could they have known.
Right.
Because they were describing him as a good employee prior to, you know, having this illness. But, you know, it can help to avoid abrupt dismissals, because that just tends to escalate tensions and it leads to, you know, dissatisfaction. So if you've got open communication, you've got periodic meetings and documentation of performance discussions, that's a better way of kind of building up to, you know, the progressive discipline, I guess.
Right.
And, you know, looking at how do you identify signs of depression and stress, and do you offer any benefits? Do you provide free or low cost or confidential counseling that can prioritize employees' well-being?
Absolutely. Mental health has to be on the same playing field, the same equal status as physical health. No question. Organizations need to break down the stigma and provide resources and support for employees who are facing mental health challenges.
I agree. Timing those terminations wisely and providing that documentation, the resources, offering terminated employees a voice, I think can also help minimize the resentment that can really build.
Mm-hmm.
And even if it's not, or in addition to, maybe you give them a voice that day, but they're kind of stunned or shocked sometimes, but even giving them an opportunity to come back and have that voice where, you know, it's in writing, they can complete a report or an exit interview. And of course, we've talked about this before, but conducting background checks for employees that have had past behavioral issues is also recommended.
You know, Dominique, I'm really passionate about these issues, and most people don't know this, but in my prior career or out of that, I actually have a master's in human resources. So all of these issues are just so important to me, and there's so many best practices out there that can really help firms and employers minimize stress, minimize problems, which ultimately minimize the risk of violence in a workplace. Addressing work employee behavior and performance problems, it's just essential for a safe work environment, just beyond being a best practice. And that means investing in training, investing in a place where people can have open dialogue, where termination is not done abruptly, but it's the logical conclusion of a series of progressive steps, and being kind about how you engage in termination. Because honestly, it's a terrible act that has to be done for both the employer and the employee. Nobody wants it. You know, in this episode, we really explored the shocking workplace shooting incident involving Anthony LaCalamita and its aftermath. And while highlighting the importance of workplace safety, we really believe in the significance of training, open communication, and compassionate policies regarding termination, especially in high-stress accounting firms, to prevent these tragedies in the future.
That was well said, Tom. I couldn't agree more. And just analyzing and looking at the consequences to constantly living under that level of stress. And so you've got somebody that's in that situation, but also is struggling with their mental wellness. And then adding that, you're just piling on. Now, it sounds like the partners were very compassionate. Yeah. And it sounds like things were kind of escalating with this guy. And what else can you do except let somebody go? But, you know, there are things that we can do. And even if those things that we can do won't prevent something like this from happening, it just creates a better workplace all around. And while the U.S. has one of the highest rates of mass shootings among developed countries, these events are relatively rare compared to other forms of gun violence. It's surprising because we tend to hear about it so much because there are multiple fatalities and injuries. But there's a lot of considerable psychological trauma for the survivors and for the wider community. I'm not aware what happened with the employees that were there that day and what kind of happened with their recovery afterwards. But it's important to note that workplace shootings, while they're highly publicized and they're impactful, their potential severity makes prevention measures a key consideration for employees and for employers alike.
I agree, Dominique. And we hope our listeners take away some valuable insights from our discussion. And really, please prioritize the mental and emotional health of your workforce. Dominique and I strongly believe that the normal culture in accounting firms is not healthy. Let's create work environments that can prevent or reduce the risk of future tragedies. Thank you, and a special thanks to all of our listeners for joining us on this captivating but really sad episode. We hope our listeners implement these insights and join us for future episodes as we delve into more gripping stories in the tax world. So thank you so much, everyone, for listening. Take what you learned today and use these truths that hit home to transform the way that you do business. Dominique and I are extremely grateful you decided to join us today. Please subscribe to the show. Please share it with friends who need a Tax Crime Junkies podcast in their life. Help us spread the word and come back for more.
And we hope you'll join us again next week as we continue our mission to find the loopholes that went left and close them for good. Until next time, remember, every crime has a trail that leads to the truth.